This is the first day of this January 2015 7-day Sesshin. Gohatsu Sesshin. And I'm going to take up an old favorite, this Sesshin, a book with the teachings of Japanese Zen Master Basui. And the book, name of the book is Mud and Water. And this is a collection of talks by Basui. We'll start with his biographical information. He was born in 1327 and died in 1387. So he's died at the age of 61. Just for a little context in terms of our own Western culture, the year that Basui was born, the Aztecs established Mexico City. Meister Eckhart died that year. And during Basui's life was the Black Death, where 75 million people died in Europe from the Black Death. Reading from the introduction to this book, Mud and Water. He was born in a period when a military family that virtually ruled over Japan for more than 100 years was losing its control over the country. Excuse me. This book was translated. These talks by Basui was translated by Arthur Braverman. So Japan was on the verge of a civil war that would last more than 50 years. Interesting parallel to what was going on in Europe. The records have it that Basui's mother had a dream that she would give birth to a demon child. And this really gnawed at her, and to shake off the fear of this omen, she was said to have abandoned the newborn Basui in a nearby field. A family servant found the child there, took him in, and raised him. There's a footnote here. This does sound plausible as a Japanese way of doing things. The translator says perhaps he was left with the understanding that the servant would pick him up. In this case, he would have been abandoned only in a formal sense in order to fend off evil spirits. It seems quite likely that the mother wouldn't be so filled with horror that she would abandon him outright, but that she would just take aside the servant and say, please, you know what to do. I'll tell you exactly where I'm going to leave the baby. When Basui was 4 years old, his father died. And then there are these prescribed memorial services done annually. And 3 years later, there was a memorial service, the annual memorial service for Basui's father. And Basui asked the monk how his father could eat the offerings placed on the altar. We have this also for ceremony. We have fruit and flower offerings every day, and for memorial services we add some kind of a grain, like a bread and tea. So this would have been done at this third year memorial service, and Basui was just curious enough that he asked how his father could eat these. This, by the way, is a question that comes up again and again at workshops, where in the last segment of the workshop, I'm sitting up in front of the altar, and someone will say, what is the point of these flowers and the fruit, or the whatever it is, the vegetable, the squash, or whatever? And it's hard to give a satisfying answer to this, because it seems superstitious somehow. So I don't try. I don't spend much time trying to help them understand it. I would say, though, that at this point, to people now listening who are less likely to be literally attached to these offerings, that there's a big difference between making a physical offering and just feeling somehow gratitude, trying to summon up feelings of respect or reverence or gratitude, to have to actually place, to prepare the fruit or vegetable offering or the flower offering, and arrange the flowers and place it on the altar, goes a lot further than just trying to come up with feelings of respect or gratitude. And respect and gratitude, of course, to Buddhas, to the enlightened ones, and by extension to our own enlightened nature, our own Buddha nature. That's what these offerings are, and they're so much more potent when they're actual physical offerings rather than just thoughts of gratitude and so forth. Well, the monk in charge of that memorial service said that his father's soul would eat the offerings. Very, by the way, very non-Buddhist notion. And then the little Basui said, "What is this thing called a soul?" And that was the head of the spear of questioning that would drive Basui for years and years to come, in fact, most of his life. So he began this questioning, what is this thing called the soul? The record says that when he was 9 years old, he was horrified by talk of the agonies of the three evil paths. Again, a footnote here. The three evil paths are the three lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. So the three evil paths would be hell, hungry ghosts, and animals. This is according to Buddhist teaching, that such realms are what we consign ourselves to if we do the most grievous kinds of transgressions against people and other beings. I'm reminded of Hakuin's terror of the stories of hell that he had heard when as a boy. No one, I can imagine, as no adult, no parent would try to, well, I take that back. I guess there are parents and other religions that might try to instill the fear of hell in a child. Looking back on it, it's hard to argue with success. It seemed to really drive him very deeply into his spiritual questioning. And then he continued to question more deeply into the meaning of a soul. And some years passed, and then this led him to another question. Who is the one who sees, hears, and understands? This would be a rough equivalent of the word soul. For long periods of time, he sat in meditation, forgetting his own body, until one day he realized there was nothing one could grasp to call the soul. It's kind of a first tentative insight into the emptiness of all phenomena. With this new view of emptiness of everything, Basui no longer felt the burden of body and mind, and his doubts about the Buddha Dharma, for the time being, were cleared up. So I suppose you might call this a kind of a first entering of the gate, maybe even a Kensho, first Kensho. And it left him relieved and more at rest. Continuing with this account, this period of tranquility continued until one day he read in a popular book, "The mind is host, the body is guest." And this prompted more doubts, more questioning to arise in Basui. And he thought, if the mind is host, then all cannot be void. This host must be the master who sees, hears, and understands that all things are empty. But who then is this master? He's thrown back into a deeper inquiry into his original question. So his original experience took some of the edge off that doubt, but now it was rekindled in hearing this new formulation about host and guest. When he was 20, Basui went to train under the Zen master Oko in his home province. But he didn't become a monk until he was 29. When he did at last officially become a monk, he had little taste for ritual and rejected the superstitions that clothed so many of the religious institutions of his time. He wouldn't wear robes, and he wouldn't recite the sutras, the chanting, like the other monks. He just did zazen, day and night, oblivious to wind, rain, and cold. This was to be Basui's way throughout his life as a Zen practitioner. There was a monk in Basui's hometown by the name of Tokuke, who had cut himself off from the world, retiring to the mountains, practicing religious austerities for many years. When Basui heard of this monk, he decided to pay him a visit. When Tokuke saw Basui with his head shaved and in layman's clothes, he asked him suspiciously, "Why don't you wear monk's robes?" Basui replied, "I became a monk to understand the great matter of life and death, not to wear Buddhist robes." Tokuke said, "I see. Then are you looking into the koans of the old masters?" Basui said, "Of course not. How can I appreciate the words of others when I don't even know my own mind?" You can see how he made light of that first experience, whatever it was, didn't consider it to be anything life-changing. Tokuke said, "Well then, how do you approach your practice?" Basui said, Having become a monk, I want to clarify the source of the great Dharma handed down by the Buddhas and the patriarchs. After attaining enlightenment, I want to save the bright and the dull, teaching each one according to his capacity. My true desire is to relieve others of their pain, even though I myself may fall into hell. See what a magnificent aspiration he had. Assuming that he was sincere about this, what he said, that he was willing to sacrifice himself for others to relieve others of pain. This is true bodhisattva aspiration. And when Tokuke heard him say this, he placed his palms together and bowed. Tokuke must have seen that he was sincere in this aspiration. And then a friendship grew between these two monks from then on. Basui vowed not to teach a word of the Dharma to others until he received certification of his own realization from a true teacher. Once he received such a sanctioning, he would devote his life to saving others, to liberating others. To fulfill this vow, he practiced harder than ever, telling himself, "This doubting mind is, after all, empty." So he brought to this new question his experience of the emptiness of things. He carried this investigation as far as he could without any real clarification. Then one day, after sitting in meditation through the night, he heard the sound of the mountain stream at dawn, and at that he had a true realization. He then went in search of a teacher to have his understanding confirmed. He heard of a master by the name of Kozan. He went to find him, and Kozan confirmed Basui's realization. This was when Basui was 31. And it was at this time that he started wearing Buddhist robes. It's interesting. He had some kind of resistance until then, but once having had the truth of the Dharma revealed to him, then he got fully on board and became ordained. Once he saw that, in other words, that the Dharma was the truth, that the Dharma is just the way things are, reality. And then he began making pilgrimages around the country, visiting various Zen masters. He went to see one called Fukuan, a Zen master who had studied in China, and who had a following that numbered about 2,000 monks. We're told here that Basui was unimpressed with Fukuan, and he went back home to see his friend Tokuke. He told Tokuke that he had not got on well with Fukuan and was planning to practice by himself in some isolated mountain retreat. Tokuke himself had spent about 20 years of severe practice and seclusion, had developed quite a bit of pride in this kind of practice, and this pride was a source of suffering to him. So he warned Basui of the dangers of becoming too smug in your precious seclusion, and and that he needed to receive transmission from a true teacher. So this suggests that neither Basui nor his friend Tokuke was satisfied with the verification that Basui had received from this master. When he heard Tokuke say, "Wait until you've had true realization confirmed by a true master before going into seclusion," he gave up the idea of this solitary practice and instead spent that year in a summer and winter training period with Tokuke. And Tokuke told Basui of a certain Master Koho, who he considered a truly great teacher. And so off Basui went to meet this Koho. Koho was the Dharma heir to great Zen Master Mumon, in Chinese Wumen, who compiled the Wumen Kan. And he was said to have been a strict teacher who greatly valued the precepts. This is something that you don't hear much about, a Japanese teacher having great respect for the precepts. I don't feel shy about saying that Japanese teachers are not known for placing much respect in the precepts. This is, really the Achilles heel of Japanese Zen. But this Koho must have been the exception. And he didn't, in fact, confirm Basui's understanding right away, but asked him to stay a while with him. Basui did stay, but as was his custom, he declined to live on the temple grounds. So what he did was live in a nearby hut, and he visited the master every day for Doksan. One day in Doksan, Koho asked Basui why Joshu, when he was asked, "Does even a dog have Buddha nature?" why he had responded with the word "mu." And in response, Basui came up with this verse: "Mountains, rivers, and the great earth, grass, trees, and forests, all are mu." Well, this did not satisfy Koho. In fact, he reprimanded him for his response. And at that, Basui felt as though the foundation of his body and mind fell off like the bottom falling off a barrel. And he expressed another verse: "Six windows naturally open, a cold lone flower. Koho strikes the rubbish from my eyes, crushes the gem in my hand right before me. So be it. This gold has become hard iron." Just a couple points about this verse. Six windows naturally open. These refer to the six sense gates. Not just the five regular senses, but the six being the sense of mind. Crushes the gem in my hand right before me. This suggests that Basui felt that he had been a little attached to his enlightenment. So Koho did him the great service of just ridding him of that attachment and leaving this, what he described as gold, transformed into hard iron, a tool, something you make tools with, something you heave earth with, that you break things up with, something useful. This awakening pointed out to Basui how narrow his previous view of emptiness was. Koho verified his understanding and gave him the name Basui, meaning far above average. Basui was 32 years old. Well, he stayed just 2 months there with Koho, and then hit the road again, and seeking out Zen masters to engage in Dharma talk. He wanted to also seclude himself in a mountain retreat in order to deepen his understanding. This is a testimony to Basui's deep aspiration, that even after a true enlightenment, he wanted to deepen it. And around this time, Basui built his first hermitage. Tokuke came to visit him there, and this time he seemed pleased with Basui's decision to retire to a hermitage to continue his practice. He seemed to be telling Basui that since he now had met both requirements, having clarified the way and having received verification from a true teacher, he was ready to undertake this kind of practice. Basui had a dream that his teacher Koho was near death. And so he went off to visit him and found that in fact he was seriously ill. And he wanted to stay on with him. But he ended up leaving for reasons that are uncertain, but perhaps related to strained relations with some long-standing disciples of the teacher. The older disciples may have resented Basui's decision to live off the temple grounds. Some were perhaps jealous of Basui for having received transmission after such a short stay with him. And all of this resentment may have been compounded by the fact that Basui did not mix with the other monks and refused to take part in the formal temple activities. Koho did die. He was 91, and Basui was 35. Basui kept moving, went to a hermitage, and on the way there, he stopped off and met a master, Jakshitsu. He had been to China, and Basui was attracted to his teaching. They talked about the meaning of monastic life. Basui always seemed to warn against the dangers of excessive formalization. This, of course, is always a danger in any religion, that it becomes so, once it becomes institutionalized, that it becomes overly formalized with ceremony and ritual. This, I must say, is what I found at the two mother temples of the Soto school in Japan, Eheiji and Sojiji. He continued to favor small hermitages over large monasteries. And he went to yet another master, says here he seems to have been attracted to the Soto sect for its stress on being attentive to all one's everyday activities. But after he had been a while at this Soto monastery, he had second thoughts about that and about the monks with their tendency toward idealization. Idealization, that's what the translator here, it's the word he uses. And I would interpret that word, idealization, as getting stuck in the notion that fundamentally we're all Buddhas, we're all enlightened, so what is there to do when we already are enlightened in our true nature? It's a kind of idealizing. And then Basui continued on his wanderings. He spent the next 17 years moving around the country, living in many hermitages. He didn't stay more than 3 years in any one place, and yet, in spite of that, a following of monks began to grow around him. As the numbers increased, he even went so far as to leave a hermitage secretly and relocate somewhere else. And then it wasn't until his late years that he finally felt ready to accept disciples in large numbers. At the age of 51, he moved to yet another hermitage on a mountain. The number of disciples kept increasing. Got to the 800 gathered there. And because of the steep mountain path and the strong winds, Basui was encouraged to move to a famous hermitage, which he did do and remained there for the rest of his life. And at this point, Basui was clearly ready to accept the role of teacher of a large institution. He accepted all who came to train under him. The number grew to over 1,000 monks and lay students. And it was at this final monastery that the talks from this book that I'm reading from were recorded. This collection of talks was published the year before Basui died. He didn't ask that they be published, but he gave his permission. It says here that in his final years, he developed great faith in the Bodhisattva Canon. I think Hakuin developed the same strong feeling for Canon in his later years. Basui referred to Kanon as Kanon was described in the Sharangama Sutra. He was a person, at this time, Kanon was still considered male, as Kanon was originally during the time of the Buddha. Basui referred to Kanon as a person who, for every sound he heard, contemplated the mind of the hearer, realizing his own nature. So, basically, who is hearing? In 1387, at the age of 61, Basui sat up in Zazen, turned to his disciples and said, "Look directly. What is this? Look in this manner and you won't be fooled." He called out the same words in a loud voice and died. just as kind of an afterword, the translator says that many of the Rinzai teachers whom Basui visited, including Koho, had some connection with a Chinese master, this master Chuho Myohon, and the Japanese followers of this lineage favored Chuho's reclusiveness. They dissociated themselves from the government-supported monasteries, preferring to live in small mountain hermitages. They were known for their austere lives and strong emphasis on zazen. In Japan, there are temples recognized by the government as training temples where you can get certified, get your certification to inherit a temple of your own. It's all very formalized, speaking of formalization. And these government-approved big monasteries, from every indication that I got when I was there in Japan and since, are not often not the best training, the highest standards. The two temples that I trained at in Japan, neither one was was considered a training temple or official training, government-sponsored training temple, at least at the time. So there's a kind of purity to a place like that where you don't have to play politics with the ecclesiastical organization. The teacher, provided the teacher is someone of true understanding, and both of them were at the places I went, they have the freedom to teach as they feel they need to, and often this can be more authentic than towing the line through some big organization of many, many different kinds of monasteries. You can see why Basui was attracted to that kind of lineage with his own uncompromising spirit and his lack of interest in politics. Our time is up now. We'll stop and resume tomorrow. Now recite the four vows.